The following is a recording of a discussion group at Ordinary Mind Zendo. The texts we take up for study in these groups range from koan collections to poetry to psychoanalytic papers. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating. Ordinary Mind Zendo is a nonprofit organization that depends on the generosity of people like you.
Somebody would like to begin by reading the case.
Mm-hmm. Whenever Master Hakujo gave Taisho and Zen, an old man sat with the monks to listen and always withdrew when they did. One day, however, he remained behind, and the master asked, "Who are you standing here before me?" The old man replied, "I am not a human being. In the past, in the time of the Kashyap Buddha, I was the head of this monastery. Once a monk asked me, 'Does an enlightened man also fall into causation or not?' I replied, 'He does not.' Because of this answer, I was made to live as a fox for 500 lives. Now I beg you, please say the turning words on my behalf and release me from this fox body." The old man then asked Hakujo, "Does an enlightened man also fall into causation or not?" The master said, "He does not ignore causation." Hearing this, the old man was at once enlightened. Making a bow to Hakujo, he said, "I have now been released from the fox body, which will be found behind the mountain. I dare to make a request of the master. Please bury it as you would a deceased monk." Continue. The master had the Ino strike the gavel and announce to the monks that there would be a funeral for a deceased monk after the midday meal. The monks wondered, saying, "We are all in good health. There's no sick monk in the Nirvana Hall. What is it all about? After the meal, the master led the monks to a rock behind the mountain, poked out a dead fox with his staff, and cremated it. In the evening, the master ascended the rostrum in the hall and told the monks the whole story. The Bhaku thereupon asked, "The old man failed to give the correct turning words and was made to live as a fox for 500 lives, you say. If, however, his answer had not been incorrect each time, what would he have become?" The master said, "Come closer to me, I'll tell you." The Bhaku then stepped forward to Hakujo and slapped him. The master laughed aloud, clapping his hands, and said, "I thought a foreigner's beard is red, but I see that it is a foreigner with a red beard."
All right, very good. Someone else read the commentary in the poem?
Oh, yeah, please.
Mumon's commentary. Not falling into causation. Why was he turned into a fox? Not ignoring causation. Why was he released from the fox body? If you have an eye to see through this, then you will know that the former head of the monastery did enjoy his 500 happy, blessed lives as a fox. Mumon's poem. Not falling, not ignoring. Odd and even are on one die. Not ignoring, not falling. Hundreds and thousands of regrets.
You all have Shibayama's commentary on this as well?
Mm-hmm.
Taisho on the corner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you see how he designates this as a nanto koan, mm-hmm. a koan of exceptional difficulty or subtlety.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, that means that it's one that's goes beyond the kind of initial realization of mu with the, well, and then what, right?
Yeah.
Right? It's the it's number two in this case, following mu, because in a sense it does challenge the notion of liberation. What does it mean? What are you liberated from, and what is that supposed to look like? If you've been working on Mu for the last 6 years and suddenly, you know, have a big experience of great freedom. We might get this koan as a follow-up to sort of say, all right, just what do you think your big experience is going to mean after all?
In the Bharata Yasutani koan curriculum, if they skip this one, and at the end of the 1400 come back to it.
Yeah, I mean, typically, they'll actually do give you all these miscellaneous koans to reinforce oneness before they go on to these koans that make you take a different perspective. But it's a good lesson to think about at any stage of practice or in any kind of practice, because it does sort of directly engage on curative fantasy of what liberation is supposed to free us from. The old abbot here asks, is an enlightened person free from cause and effect? And it's a fancy way of asking, can I have an experience that will in some sense wipe the slate clean of my past trauma, my past neurosis, my wipe the slate clean of my personal history, right? And there's some way in which I think students inevitably have that fantasy or wish of a kind of clean slate experience, right? And it's certainly possible if you are a particular kind of samadhi freak or bliss ninny in your practice to attain temporary states where you feel like the slate has been wiped clean, that everything is nothing but the clear blue sky in all directions, right? And your only problem is trying to hold on to it permanently, right? But you have that kind of tantalizing experience in meditation, right? And if you're the opposite and never get the clear sky, you just spend all your time sitting around thinking there's something wrong with you that you don't have it, because that's what's obviously supposed to happen. So the koan engages that level of fantasy of what does it mean to engage your own karma, your own history. In the koan, we hear, this is what happens to you if you get the answer wrong. And Ahaka is a wise ass, and he gets up there and he asks, what would happen to him if he got the answer right? Yeah. Well, what difference does it make, right? I do like the exchange of come closer and I'll tell you. I mean, it's sort of a standard old Zen master ploy, It's, although it's in a certain sense, it may not be so clear that the slapping each other around is a good answer to the question of what would happen if you got it right. What is that? What's that saying? In what way is that an answer to the question? Or is it just a dismissal of the question? And what would you offer as sort of different versions of what would happen if you get the answer right or wrong, right? What does it, what does that say to you? What is a personal kind of answer to this question, right? I know you always tell us this is your favorite koan. Would you like to give us a demonstration? What is it?
This koan is so important to me that it's hard for me to talk about it.
You have to say something.
Even if you're repeating someone else.
Yes, what is the, what makes it important? Why does it stand out for you? Why is this koan different from all other koans?
It's like, why is Buddhism important to me? I find it very freeing. I find the experience of the koan very opening, very freeing in ways that I'm not naturally, at least I don't. I feel often very constrained.
Does it bring out your inner fox?
Yes. But also my inner priest.
Priest, yeah.
And my inner monk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's limitless in that way. And it helps me realize how integrated I am with the rest of humanity. Mm. Like we're all in the same boat together, this great big rowboat with nobody at the helm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I take comfort in that.
See, I think that when you look at the koan from the perspective of the abbot and the monk and the fox and these different characters, in that sense, one of the things you're doing is using it to enact different self states, right? And that is one kind of way you can say koans offer liberation, is they get maybe they particularly get uptight or macho male monks to move freely through a lot of different self states,
mm-hmm.
through a certain kind of pantomime or throwing themselves into the roles respectively, right? So that part of what that means is a kind of non-attachment to any one privileged persona.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and allowing yourself to let go and freely be fox-like, right, or be Obako, be this, you know, 6.5 foot tall, imposing character, you know, come has the nerve to come up and slap the teacher, right? Would you like to try that one? Please. Go for it, right? So that's the...
Beware of what you ask.
That's right, beware of it, that's right. So come closer and we'll give it a try, right? We'll see who's the quicker draw. but, so there is a at that level of a particular kind of liberation of play.
Yes.
Right, it's the liberation of the playful movement between self states, and in a sense, the koan, you know, mu is about this one kind of dichotomy between a monk and a dog. You know, the preferred versus the despised self states. And that comes to a different kind of resolution. You can't answer mu by barking, right? That's it's a wrong answer. But here you've got a different kind of playfulness where you do move into the playfully move into all the characters. Right? That's a it's a different kind of koan, a different kind of answer.
And I think the image of the fox itself, a fox by definition is rather playful, and I don't know if the word escaped me, but it evokes a whole character of letting go and being loyal.
Yes, being wild and letting go, and in a certain sense, I suppose it's the opposite of a disciplined precept-following monk. Mm-hmm. It's a wild spirit. Mm-hmm. Right?
There's something about that is the not falling into causation aspect of the answer, and I think the question is, how do you bring that into not ignoring? Where you become
mm-hmm.
Parnell again, but with that insight, like that sort of, because I don't think it's that either one is wrong. I think that, like, they can inform each other, or the perspective.
Well, I mean, my interest in these koans is how do you really make them. Personal or psychologically mm-hmm. relevant. You know, I think that you can experience a certain kind of letting go and freedom by coming off your cushion and playing with being a fox.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that's non-trivial. I mean, it's being able to give yourself just physically the freedom and presence to do that can be very healing for somebody who is always trying to do the right, proper thing all the time. Right, it's something that involves a certain kind of psychological or social letting go in an enactment. I think that to answer the koan at that level probably though doesn't engage people's curative fantasy of the blank slate, however.
Yeah, this reminds me of another Nanto koan, the buffalo's tail.
Yeah.
Like they both seem to address what is it you think practice is going to do for you.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's right. And I think all of them do in a certain way. And that's that's maybe just my particular shtick that I bring to all the koans.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think this is going to do for you?
Mm-hmm.
But that's right. The buffalo's tail and this
mm-hmm.
one are sort of.
Or they threaten this fantasy once and for all.
That's right. The
mm-hmm.
the buffalo's tail is, you can the whole damn buffalo passes through except its tail, right? There's always some damn thing left over, right? You can't quite mop up or clean up or finish once and for all, right?
And you know what comes with the tail.
Yeah. I never thought about that.
Yeah. What?
You know. Little poop. I'm just kidding.
What about the foreigner? The red-bearded foreigner is like an other,
it's like,
kind of not,
where does
not
that come from?
Something for different and foreign, not belonging to us.
Well, I mean, that's a red-bearded foreigner is usually a description of Bodhidharma, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
He's if Bodhidharma is coming from India, somehow you don't think of Indians being redheads.
It's like a Scottish.
Yeah, it's a Scottish Bodhidharma.
Why take the red beard to evoke the fox again?
That's the fox.
Yeah, sometimes people interpret it that way too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. what do you take to be this distinction? I thought the foreigner's beard is red, but I see that it is a foreigner with a red beard. What do you take to be the distinction that is trying to be made there in terms of reframing this?
I think in general, the koan is about not making distinctions, about the vision of differences, of, you know, it sort of begs the question of what difference does this all make anyhow. I think it's sort of like just a kind of a trick question, I think, at the end, but you know, there might be more to it.
Or I see, I thought you were not the foreigner, but I see that you are the foreigner.
Something like that. I mean, that there's no difference between you and a red-bearded foreigner.
Mm-hmm. And the presentation of the koan, the you know, narrative, it's very clearly, you know, stated that, oh my God, I'm stuck in this horrible wild fox body for 500 lives. What a miserable, horrible fate. Please liberate me. Oh, now I'm enlightened and I'm liberated. So that like lays it right out there that this is what, you know, it's about. But in like, you know.
And then it turns it upside down. But it starts with joining people's fantasy of freedom from, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, but it turns it around into freedom through non-separation,
mm-hmm.
right? Non-separation mm-hmm. here is non-separation with the karma, with cause and effect, so that...
with your personal history.
With your personal history, right?
So Shibayama later has this line where he says, when a fox is really a fox, he is truly a former head of a monastery. When an old man cannot be an old man and goes astray with his dualistic thinking, he is a fox. So there's this sense of like not being able to own your past is what traps you.
Yes, I think that's a good way to,
mm-hmm.
to put it. I think that in general, people try to use practice to climb out of their own skin. When you climb back in, when you allow yourself to be who you are, that's the freedom that has eluded you all this time because you thought the freedom was escape from rather than escape into.
So is some aspect of this like coming to terms with the facts that like maybe you were a fox for 500 lives before you finished your move, or like all your foxy behavior, you know, there seems to be some before and after.
Well, it's like saying if the old man had answered it correctly, he would have been reborn as you, right? I mean, it's what
mm-hmm.
was supposed to happen, right? Well, now it would be exactly where you are now.
Mm-hmm.
I think that. You know, I always thought a nice answer to this koan would be to sing Still Crazy After All These Years. Because that's more in line with, you know, what you imagine you're going to be released from.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That there's some way in which think that somehow or another our personal craziness is going to evaporate. In some sense, our relationship to all that history changes, but it's not one of evaporation.
Mm-hmm. And yet, it's not wholly deterministic either, because there is the principle of cause and effect, and the possibility in the intersection there that of making something happen. You spoke in an earlier talk about agency, and I think that the way in which cause and effect interact gives rise to a possibility for agency. So we've been thinking of karma in purely negative terms, but I think there's more to it than that.
Well, I think there's a very complicated relationship between cause and effect and agency.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's not just that we have choices and then they have consequences, because part of how we understand our choices is that they're conditioned by previous cause and effect. So there's no completely free point to stand for agency, yet at the same time we don't think of things as totally deterministic.
Mm.
A big issue when we look at these freedom and betrayal chapters is precisely the relationship between freedom and necessity. A number of these authors, along with Dogen, are going to try to arrive at an almost mystical identity between freedom and necessity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that the cause of suffering in this kind of koan is the attempt to fight against or stand outside of necessity and cause and effect, right? So there, it's a kind of I fought the law and the law won, right? We hear the law is the law of cause and effect,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
D.T. Suzuki someplace was asked, what is the meaning of freedom in Zen? And he said, the elbow does not bend backwards.
Mm.
Right? So it's again that kind of identification of freedom and necessity. Right? So the freedom means embracing the life of the fox. Right? Being in hell means endlessly fighting against your fox nature, right?
Giving the fox a funeral means giving him jukai. It's essentially,
Well, giving the fox a funeral, in a sense, is the bringing together of the opposites, right? It's
mm-hmm.
it's dissolving the difference between fox and man, right? Two things that you've held as polar opposites, you're treating as if now they're actually one.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
But you know, I think we do have a tendency, partly what you're saying, to think of ourselves as the effect of all these past causes.
Mm-hmm.
But we're just as much now
potentially
the cause of
the next set, right.
The next
right.
effect.
Right.
So and we I don't think we put as much emphasis on that.
Well, I think we can dip into that circle at any point.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
mm-hmm.
And in part, when we talk about koans this way, we're doing it because I have, through my own agency, adopted a different non-traditional
mm-hmm.
attitude toward
mm-hmm.
koans. I'm not presenting to you what was given to me,
yeah.
right? I'm doing something different.
Mm-hmm.
I'm making a decision to change the course of things.
Mm-hmm.
The agency thing reminds me too of what you said about the therapy in the Bromberg stuff, how through like empathic interaction, we try to give the patient more options at the edge of what their cause and effect have given them.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of
mm-hmm.
seems like...
Yeah, I mean, Bromberg, sort of sees it in terms of, in a large sense, modeling a different degree of agency or freedom and enacting that with the person, right? It has to be, and it's an area where I'm not 100% in agreement with him, but where he thinks that the modeling of self-reflection on the analyst part enables the patient to self-reflect in a different way than they would have been otherwise. The analyst has a kind of capacity to tolerate or move between self-states that is in some way going to be contagious.
Mm-hmm.
And there is something of that in the way Nakujo and Obako interact, where there's a way in which you're trying to model a different perspective or a question.
Yeah.
Well, like, I feel like when we try to come to terms with cause and effect and agency, it's usually us in a vacuum, not interacting with like other people
who
show us a different
option. I had this thought about agency, which may or may not, which I think is that you can be a cause as an agent, but the effect you cannot control.
Right.
You can hope for, but there's all these other factors and things that will impinge, so that agency is never really pure in a sense. Well, it's pure as an action, but not as a generating a result.
Yes, it doesn't guarantee a result. I think, though, that psychologically, one of the paradoxes of agency that Kohut used to point out was that we feel that we have the most free will and the most agency when we're securely embedded in a self-object system.
Mm-hmm.
When we have all our secure attachments in place, that's when we feel the most free and agenic.
Mm-hmm.
Agenic, I guess.
When we're the most tied down.
We're the most embedded, we're the most supported,
mm-hmm.
right? That actually, that gives us the stability and cohesion from which to act. And
mm-hmm.
that in the absence of that, we are often in a kind of unregulated, fragmented, discombobulated state where we can't ever make up our mind what to do or how to do it.
There's such a parallel to this in like Christian, discussion of like free will.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have free will or did God determine everything?
Yeah.
So is your so called free will just really determined
right.
by God? Or
yeah, and so some groups painted themselves into a corner of predestination,
mm-hmm.
right? And then had to, work through why anybody should feel responsible for how they act if it's all predestined. There's no good way out of the problem of free will, which I think Owen Flanagan called the black hole of Western philosophy. but it is a subjective psychological reality and necessity. It starts with
mm-hmm.
you feeling like you have control over your own body. And the whole notion of the development of the self or the ego in infancy is about control and impact.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that I discover who I am by being able to make mommy smile.
Mm-hmm.
My whole sense of who I am arises out of agency and impact. So it's not possible to be the kind of creature we are without a notion of free will. It's built in.
Mm-hmm.
It's built into our experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the idea of God's will is the exact parallel to Buddhist karma. But each one could be conceived in some ways as like completely determinative.
Well, I think there's a, in all these systems, you have a sense of what, you know, of this interplay between freedom and necessity. You know what are you constrained by and what are you responsible for? Religion always ends up with some notion of individual responsibility, because mostly they're systems of controlling people.
Having been brought up a Calvinist,
yes.
Presbyterian,
mm-hmm.
Very strict Calvinist Presbyterian, and I think helps explain why this koan was so, the experience of this koan. It's not the logic of it so much as the like full-hearted experience that allows me to play with it, but to know to have a sense of freedom from that predestined.
From predestination.
Yes.
And to let yourself play it. All right, I'm going to go to hell. I'll be a fox.
No, I'm already there.
Yeah, that,
I'm not going anywhere. I'm already there.
Yeah, I don't have to go anywhere. I don't have to be ashamed of it.
That's right.
Yeah.
I don't have to be guilty.
That's right. Mm. Just have fun.
Yeah, right.
The fox here is always associated, though, with some kind of evil intent, and I don't understand it that way at all. Maybe because where I live, I have foxes, you know, trot across my yard, and well, they're not cute, they're clever. Mm. They're animals. They're wild. They're simply wild. They're not bad. They're, what's the word, feral?
Yeah, and I guess there is, again, they represent the side of an argument that sees wild or nature as uncontrolled and in some sense dangerous, the opposite of domesticated,
mm-hmm.
right? You can't
right.
domesticate a fox, right?
You know, when a fox gets into, you probably know this, and this is not, into a hen house,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he's the most reviled of you don't want that, because
want that.
What he will do, the hen, is he just kills.
He'll kill all.
That's right.
And he doesn't.
And he doesn't eat them.
Doesn't eat them. He doesn't want. He just wants to kill, which is.
So, yeah,
unlike human beings.
Well, I wasn't. I was not drawing anything.
Yeah, yeah. So certainly, you know, the Chinese mythology of the fox
right.
is not cute and cuddly. I mean,
not at all.
It is sort
sly
of,
as a fox.
It's a sly,
yeah.
mm-hmm. somewhat dangerous demon.
He's a problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But. Part of what we were saying about it, how do you think about the natural, right? Is it is your human nature essentially good or and something you want to recover? I just want to become more natural with who I am. Or is my nature something that I need to get under control, domesticate, or somehow suppress because it's going to get me in a lot of trouble. And, you know, both Buddhism and Christianity have, you know, at their, you know, founding myths, some notion of the dangers of desire, whether you call that original sin or you call it attachment. There's a sense that one version of them says that who you are has this built-in danger to it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we all have our inner fox.
Our inner fox, we better watch out for it, right? And so part of this koan is the restoring natural to a positive meaning rather than something that is wild and out of control and needs to be tamed or extirpated. Right?
Well, bringing in Christianity, the inner fox
reminds me of what, and what Julie said, so it reminds me of Judaism, just the evil inclination. I don't know the Hebrew word for it.
Evil inclination?
The evil inclination is that we all have this inner fox, or this dark side. It's part of us.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
To watch it.
That the fox enjoys himself.
Yeah.
You know, that
yeah.
like vice is fun. We don't have to pretend that we were tyrannized by these things entirely.
Uh-huh.
But like, you know, some of them were delightful. And he mentions that in the poem, I think, about regrets. That regrets aren't like a sign of broken life. It's like,
yes, I think that that's right. That the notion of all these regrets is, it's not as if we should have done it perfectly.
This fox has been released.
Right?
Your description sounds like the high schools of America today.
I don't think he's quite going out and saying sin boldly.
No.
But there is some sense in which it's a kind of anti-perfectionist stance, right? Something about...
particularly looking back on your past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't getting it wrong, per se. It's just...
How's your life?
Mm-hmm. There's a part of this... I found this very difficult, by the way, to understand.
Mm.
On 34, this is in the commentary, I'm showing Koan. This goes back to this agency thing, which I find very difficult. There's a paragraph that says, the fact of cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
So in that paragraph, this being the case, the man of real freedom would be the one who lives in peace in whatever circumstances cause and effect bring about.
Yes.
That seems to me highly problematic, but keep going. Whether the situation be favorable or adverse, he lives it as the absolute situation of his whole being, that is, he is causation itself. He never dualistically discriminates different aspects of the situation. His heart is never disturbed by any outside elements. And we can go on, but anyway, when he lives like he is the master of cause and effect, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so what does that mean? If you find yourself, I guess this is why I connected the agency. If you find yourself in a situation of, if you recognize that you are oppressed, if you have an insight that the situation in which you find yourself, that you are oppressed, that is the reality. You haven't seen it before. You recognize that it is. What does it mean to say that somebody, whether favorable or adverse, you live it with your whole being. Right there, that's what peace is. I don't understand that. It seems to me that the agency, some notion of agency, is that in that moment of clarity, you see the possibility of being able to change.
Yeah, I think you misinterpret at peace as meaning passively accepting of.
Mm-hmm.
To be at peace with it may mean that you completely accept the fact that the house is on fire and you've got to either put it out or get out.
Yeah.
So that it ought to mean at peace with having to respond appropriately in that moment, right? I just have to deal with this.
Martin Luther King could be said to have been at peace with the civil rights situation.
Yes, I mean, it would be a mistake to interpret this in too quietest a way. I think that what the part I object to is a couple lines down where he says that this is the...
indescribable.
The indescribable spiritual happiness the Zen man enjoys.
But he's just...
See, that's
just messing around there, don't you think?
I agree.
Probably.
Right, it's like, doesn't that sound awesome?
I think he's just
as shitty as things get.
There's a certain way he's fucking with your head.
Yeah, totally.
But it's a little bit more like... The happiness of a Zen man is like when it's cold, the cold kills the monk, and when it's hot, the heat kills the monk. your happiness, again, is of non-separation. It doesn't mean that you're a listening. And whatever is happening, you've just got a big silly smile on your face.
You're not cold waiting to be warm. Like, I think the happiness is the absence of the waiting.
I wonder, too, if it's a distinction between accepting the situation and being open to it. And simply being not fighting it.
Yes, no, but not fighting it doesn't mean being non-responsive.
Not denying it.
Not denying it.
That's the situation.
Yeah. But see, yes. I think that that's, to me, that's why the issue has to do with what ignore means.
They have to do with what?
What ignore refers to. Under most circumstances, most of us ignore the oppression of us. We ignore it. We don't see it. We don't recognize it. We don't act in relationship to it. So I think that, for me, part of the complexity here has to do with how does one recognize how to respond to what one typically ignores.
Ignore on purpose, you mean, or unconsciously?
I think,
for a whole variety of reasons. I mean, we live in a world, most of us in this room are very privileged people who live in a world where we ignore most things that happen in the world. So if you see it, which I think this is, if you have some moment of clarity, I think it is partly what is one's responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
What are the, it's kind of like the relative weights of ignoring.
Well, I think I think it's right in terms of this notion of responsibility, in the sense, what is the range of responses you feel are at hand? I think that a big change in Buddhism from classical times till now is that we would see that we have some agency or responsibility in the social arena. Traditionally, Buddhism in Japan and China treated politics like the weather. You simply did not presume to think you're going to have any control over who is emperor, right? You just had, you rode that out. Your response was mostly internal. You know how you handle yourself, but it wasn't, we've got to all organize, rise up, and get rid of this emperor and replace him with a better one, right? That wasn't an option. Most of the time, we will still treat our social environment like the weather. We're not going to think that in the moment we have any immediate agency over it. We live in a society where we'll say, well, every now and then we can get up and vote, or we can organize, or maybe I can go, you know, work, in some social agency setting that'll switch this. But mostly, agency, to feel agency means to feel like there's a lever at hand for you to pull, right? You have to feel like there's something where you've got some actual leverage, right? And mostly if that doesn't immediately present itself, then you have to move back into the weather perspective.
Mm-hmm. See, I think that the Bhagavad Gita, in very large part, is dealing with exactly this question.
Mm-hmm.
And its answer is that, first of all, we can't really avoid action. We can fool ourselves into thinking that we are, but we can't really. And we have agency for the action and a responsibility for the action. But what we don't have agency for is the results of the action.
Right, exactly.
And that's where the peace comes in. You do what you do, or as it says in there, you fight the battle with peace in your heart. You still fight the battle, but you're not demanding that it be come out the way you want it or think it should come out.
But you have to fight the battle. You can't step outside of your own.
Yeah, you can't.
Your,
it says you can't.
History,
you
right?
really can't do that.
Right? Yeah. Arjuna, you're a prince.
You go out
people
and fight.
In battle, you've got to go out and fight,
mm-hmm.
right? Which is sort of not the usual notion of what the spiritual teacher is going to tell you to do, mm-hmm. but it's you have to accept your karma in that, in mm-hmm. the sense of your mm-hmm. your situation, and wholeheartedly join into it.
It's a funny kind of freedom too.
It's a freedom and a necessity.
And some, right? Some scholars think that actually the Gita was at least in part written as a response to what was seen as Buddhism retreating from the world at that point mm-hmm. into this monastic mm-hmm. way of life.
Mm-hmm. What religion text is that? Is that,
well, it's
Hindu? Or?
Yeah, it's probably the prime Hindu text.
I think that this, I really appreciate that. I'm mm-hmm. ignorant of that tradition completely, and it's really interesting. I think that there's a little point that's made. I should like to say, not falling into causation mm-hmm. and not ignoring causation. How are they different? Mm-hmm. Such a logical contradiction makes this a good and interesting one. I think that's a really interesting mm-hmm. little distinction. Mm-hmm. Not falling into it, not ignoring it. How can you hold these two things simultaneously?
Well, what does not falling into it mean? And does that mean that you don't, I don't know what the word is. If you fall into it, if you surrender yourself and become somehow identified with it, is falling into it. I don't know. I mean,
see, both of those things sound rather passive to me. So maybe the thing
they
is,
are.
You make the choice, and you realize you're making the choice, and you take responsibility for making the choice.
Yeah, I think in general the intent of the koan is in the direction of to wipe out fantasies of transcendence, mm-hmm. you know, of rising above, fill in the blank, right, in terms mm-hmm. of your personal history or your human nature, right? And it's a kind of how do you come back down to earth and accept your full humanity, including your vile fox side, the side that is going to be not the purified precepts governed life of the perfect monk. Mm-hmm. See, in a certain sense, it's a it's sort of going against that kind of Theravadan picture of, if you only keep all the rules perfectly, you're going to, in some sense, enact the enlightened life, right? Mm-hmm. There's some way in which it's saying, no, there's a kind of intrinsic nature that all this practice does not allow you to rise above. Mm-hmm.
I know we're almost out of time, but I just have one clarifying question.
Yep.
Okay. I understood this to be that there was an old man sitting with the monks, not an old fox. That there was actually a man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Everybody understood it like that?
Yes.
Yes. But I like the idea of an old fox sitting there.
It's a fairy tale. He's an old man.
So when he comes, but the point is, when he comes to Hakujo and he's like, I'm a fox, Hakujo's like, no, you're not, dude. You're just a man. I'll go kick a dead fox out back if you want me to, but you're a man.
Well, he plays with the fairy tale quality of this and believes that, in fact, he is a...
He gives him what he wants.
Yeah. He just joins with the situation.
Yeah.
Right?
I've seen some translations where he's a ghost, like trying to address mm-hmm. this problem.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's a ghost?
Yeah, like
the
there's a
man.
Fox body. And he's
yeah, I really
he's
like that one.
Though,
yeah, yeah,
yeah.
It's like a ghost story, kind of. Yeah,
yeah, it's
yeah.
a ghost story.
But the fox has to die. Why does the fox have to be dead for this to...
Well, he just... He, I guess the fox just finished life 500.
I thought it was just a fox that they dug up, you know, like as a to pretend that this
no,
is
he's the, he's, yeah.
Oh, there's an old fox. Let's get
right.
an old dead fox.
He's announcing, you know, my punishment was to live 500 lives as a fox.
Mm-hmm.
I've now completed those 500 lives.
You'll find me.
You know, and can we have closure on this, right? Or maybe it's also saying, now you can take my place if you you don't get the answer right.
Well, the last line is that the 500 happy, blessed lives.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
See, so that turns the whole story upside down. Right? It's not punishment,
mm-hmm.
the way it's presented.
It's very Oscar Wilde.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right, next week, on to Berlin.
Oh, boy.
Next week, Berlin.